Hello, everyone. Hello, and welcome to 372 Pages We'll Never Get Back. I am Mike Nelson, and you are, sir?
Connor Lestoka. How's it going, Mike?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm good. We had a day yesterday in Burlington, Vermont, you know, 30 minutes from the Canadian border, that 68 degrees, I think, was the high.
Oh, well, aren't you special? I believe we once again touch zero again here in Minnesota.
It's, you know, I asked you the day before if you were getting the heat wave, and it just, you know, it was not a, it was not like a leading question to like.
I thought you had looked ahead and was,
But I'm under, you know, I've lived here for 2.5 years and I still am working under the assumption that we're pretty much, you know, me and you are experiencing the same thing all the time, 900 miles away from each other, but I guess not.
Nope. I am killing polar bears with my bare hands on the hour here in Minnesota. So for those of you who wonder why and what the hell we're talking about, Mike Nelson, Connor Lestoka, 372 pages, it's a podcast, right? And what we're doing is we're talking through and reading through with our audience and ourselves the book Armada by Ernest Cline. And this is the second in a series of podcasts we did, Ready Player One. And we're so enthused by it that we went on to his follow-up book. Do I have that right, Connor?
Yeah, there was a word then there that I might have slightly objected to. Enthused was a questionable choice. But yeah, we're talking through this guy's books because they proved – fertile ground for discussing with our listeners and reading and debating whether or not to hurl books across the room. So,
well, that's a form of enthusiasm, right? I mean, it takes at least some energy. It let's say it provokes strong emotions, either positive or negative.
It very much so. And it's like the time is right because if you've been watching the Olympics at all for the past 2 weeks, you've probably seen ads for the Ready Player One movie that's coming out in just about 1 month. There was one on yesterday. I always have it on mute, so I didn't really notice anything. But they had like scenes from the movie of, you know, the Gunters intercut with like these Olympians pulling off these spectacular feats, and then it's like a Gunter, you know, sitting in a burned out trailer park, like pretending that he's driving a race car or something. So it was a good synergy. There's a lot of similar themes going on there.
And I've heard that the Olympians to each other on the teams, that when they mess up or they have a bad run or something, they say, "You pulled a Pendergast." It's like sweeping the Olympic village. So
yeah, that's the agony of defeat guy going down the ski jump.
Yeah. Wow. Ernest Cline is intimately tied in with this global phenomenon of the Olympics.
Yep. Higher, faster, stronger.
Hard to believe.
Higher, faster, stronger, Gunter. We took a week off because you went and performed in London. Did you read Armada in any of the jolly old special Piccadilly Circus take a break to do it? Or
I did not, but we did a show at Leicester Square and met the fans afterwards that showed up, and that was really great. We have never been over and performed in the UK before. I've been over there but haven't performed or anything. And at least two or three people mentioned the podcast, which was gratifying. But nice. One chap, and I believe it was his wife or girlfriend, forgive me, sir, if I don't remember that correctly, came up just beaming, and I was like, oh, here's a happy fan. This guy looks good. And he's just like, Armada, huh? That's all he wanted to talk about was Armada. He had been hurt by it, and he was just so happy and relieved that we were doing something about it, however small our effort is. So was really cool. How about yourself? You went to San Diego.
I did, yeah. I read Armada just on the flight back because there was a lot of other stuff to do. But yeah, I saw a lot of old friends. Reunited, a lot of their children were there, but the highlight for me was we went down to watch the sunset on like this Balboa Park golf course that's a couple of blocks from Adam's house. And you know, everyone just sort of like, it was a Terrence Malicky magic hour kind of moment. These kids are running around, but then someone's like, "Hey Connor, look over there," and they pointed, and someone had brought their corgi down. I walked on over. I had a bucket of cheese balls under my arm because someone had given me a bucket of those. So I went over and got permission to feed this corgi some of the cheese balls. And it was a pretty special moment.
Wow, you are an eccentric man. Someone gave you a bucket of cheese balls, which you shared with a corgi.
The corgi's father or whatever, the owner, the wife was okay. She was from Alexandria, which is where I went to high school. And the dad was not into the cheese ball thing. He was just like reluctantly like, maybe he was thinking about cleaning up the poop or...
But you charged ahead with it anyway. No compunction.
At some point in time, he was like, "That's enough."
Wow.
But yeah, it was pretty cool.
Sort of a strange Pee Wee Herman-ish moment, going over and feeding cheese balls to someone's corgi. All right, well, let's dive in. Do you want to bring him up to speed about where we are up to this point?
Yeah, I mean, you know,
I assume they've read along with us, but
hey, hopefully, but not much has happened, and that's I feel like that sort of holds true for these next four chapters. Like, so up to this point, we've met our hero, who is a sort of repressed rage gamer in his senior year of high school, who has a insanely hot mom and is one of the best in the world at Armada, a flight simulator video game. And he, as we just left him, he'd been dropped off picked up by one of the ships from the game, and he had rocketed into space on their way to Nebraska or Iowa. I'm sure that for Ernest Cline's purposes, those two states are interchangeable.
Yes.
But so yeah, they're in outer space, and his old father figure slash comic book guy Ray is sort of giving him the lowdown on what's happening, which is essentially that the video game he's been playing his entire life turns out to be real, created by the government sort of as a front for this unnamed menace that is fast approaching Earth.
Yep, that's where we are. And so he and, well, I guess we'll learn that a bunch of other people are being recruited. And so let's dive in. What do you got?
Yeah. So right off the bat, this is something that I usually read these sections twice, which is
what?
Yeah. Well, I read them once through, and then, you know, maybe you notice stuff at the end that like you realize was a theme going on. So then I go back and read them again. it's disappointing to me that you're not doing that. I mean,
it's kind of like how we do movies for Riff Tracks. I go over it. I do.
Right.
I guess I read them twice. I guess
okay.
I do. But the, you know, when you, like you say, you find something that is so absurd, and then a couple paragraphs later, like, oh, he meant to do that. That was a clumsy setup for this. So you do have
right.
to go back.
Or in this case, there is something that you read and you're like, well, that is clumsy. And then it happens five more times throughout the chapter. So this was, I mean, throughout the section. So this is something that has been happening before in this book, but it happened a lot in this section, and it was impossible to ignore.
Yeah.
He's up in space. And he's looking at the, you know, the curvature of the Earth or something. And he says, the sight was overwhelming and made the little kid inside me involuntarily whisper, wow. Unfortunately, he must have whispered it out loud, because then Ray noticed him or something like that. And this is something that has been happening a lot, and where he sort of he's not in control of his own faculties. Like,
yeah, he's an observer to the side of his own exclamations. It's one of the strangest.
And so I noticed, so there's four other instances of this happening where I'm just going to list them off. He says, I was still wondering if I had the courage to go sit near her when I realized I was already moving in that direction. That's talking to the hot babe that he meets. And then during that conversation, or then later when the guy's doing the briefing, he says, I heard myself let out an uneasy sigh. Later on, the eye patch guy is talking. He gripped the edges of the podium as if to steady himself. It made me realize that I was doing the same thing with the armrests of my chair. And then the final one was a handful of ADI-88 interceptors appeared on the screen, and I felt my jaw go involuntarily slack. So yeah, he's having these constant out-of-body experiences that, I think in the hands of somebody else, I'd be like, maybe that's supposed to tie into the time that he blacked out in a rage during the incident and found himself beating the guy to a pulp. But I think it's just sort of a very clumsy fiction 101 trope that he's repeating for whatever reason.
I was going to say that is my theory, is don't read into that. I believe it was probably something that he read in the novelization of the Gorn Captain episode or something, you know, and he just... or some sort of fanfic that he read and thought, that's pretty neat. And he tucked it in his pocket and he forgot that he used it four times. You know,
right.
I think that's all it is.
So that's what he's showing up at the the crystal base, which he arrives at. And I noticed that there was a word I hadn't particularly heard used before when he arrives. He's describing sort of like the silos that conceal the missiles in all those areas. And he talks about how there were many outbuildings there.
Yeah.
Is that something that you're familiar with?
Yeah, it's a it's sort of a rural term.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have the central building.
Elite, I guess I don't know. That. We call them sheds out here. But
you probably don't even know what a scaredy light is then.
I do not. Is that a motion sensor?
It's like a light in the middle of a large yard or something. Yeah, that just keeps a little bit of illumination on your 80 acres or whatever. Scaredy light.
All right, cool. Well, that's I hope those make an appearance. So that was my first sort of stop and wonder what he was talking about. But I guess I'm the fool here.
No. My first stop, I'll get to mine, was the – and you probably have the same thing. We often overlap on these. So you're hearing us live both discovering our irritations and notes about these things. He brings out a thing which is very Kleinian towards the beginning. Once he realizes that there's these resources being put to bear against this force that he never knew existed, he said, "I grew up believing that despite our aspirations, humans were still a bunch of bipedal apes. Bipedal, I don't know. Divided in arbitrary tribes that were constantly at war over their ruined planet's dwindling natural resources." Now, he's brought this up before, and I think we've raised the issue that he does a spoken word piece that you can find online. That is an expansion of this idea that we're all revolting apes who somehow broke off into tribes and kill each other, and to rapturous applause by some audience somewhere.
Yeah.
Look it up on YouTube. But he's convinced he's an ape. I don't
understand
why does he even write books if he thinks he's an ape?
Imagine being a friend of someone who regularly performs spoken word pieces. And like enduring sitting through a spoken word piece and then like being like, well, at least that's over with. I will never have to listen to that rant again. I've put in my time. You know, I went there, I bought the 2-drink minimum, and then you realize that he's putting his spoken word pieces, wedging them into his novels as well. It's like, you did this bit, man. You know, I endured you at the cocktail party, you know, glancing over to the side of the room where people were having fun, but stop talking about this. You've made your point.
I wonder, did the editor and anyone who has ever seen his spoken word or anything, where did he get the idea that he had an insight here? I mean, this is, right. Maybe it was in the margin, there's like terrible insight and the terrible got smudged by coffee or something. He's like, I do have an insight, don't I?
Well, the fact that it's so clearly his insight, when more stuff like this will come up later, when the character is having these sort of revelations and talking about how we had always thought we were apes rampantly burning fossil fuels. And it's like the character has exhibited no self-awareness. All he does is talk about Star Wars with a bunch of idiots. Like there's been no, if this has been something he's been at all concerned about, it's like just been something that he's kept to himself from the reader.
I love that there's a little touch there. It's Kleinian, and you can never take it too much at face value, but he said, "I grew up believing." It wasn't that he believed that now, or "I arrived at the belief that." It's he grew up believing, so it's sort of like, well, is that his mom, you know, in between watching back-to-back episodes of Say Anything, was like pumping this stuff into his head? I don't understand where he got it.
Yeah, I guess you could say like I grew up a you know, Redskins fan type of thing, like that. You know, if like, you know, your dad is bouncing you on your knee and showing you the game at your 2 years old type of thing, that could work. But it's unlikely that she was like tucking him in and being like, now just remember our wanton use of fossil fuels is because we're a bunch of warring apes that are unable to sort out our differences.
So. Right. But in a tremendously representative Kleinian touch, this attitude does not last long. No, in the next paragraph, he says, and I quote, "We weren't a bunch of primitive monkeys teetering on the brink of self-destruction after all. This appeared to be an entirely different..." And he goes on to say that he was proud of his... For the first time, he was proud of his race and his planet, and it turns out we weren't a bunch of apes. So, quick turnaround, we learn that he thinks we're apes, and then we learn that he no longer thinks we're apes. So thank you, Klein.
It's a giant leap, and he sort of goes back and forth this throughout this whole section that we read today, where obviously, if we're taking any of this, you know, as we're supposed to, this is a a realization that has rocked his worldview. It's turned everything on its heels. Everything has sort of been a lie. But he doesn't really act like that is the type of realization that happened. I mean, he's, as we'll see later, like there's, most of us would be like on our backs, probably like weeping just because we have no idea like what is real. It's like the Truman Show almost, but, he very quickly sort of gets over this monumental thing. Like, you know, we haven't been burning fossil fuel to this. We've been overpopulating the planet to survive. But then he's like just as quickly back to one-liners about Sonic the Hedgehog and Snake Plissken, and just there's no sense that these realizations are taking hold.
Yeah, and he also observes that the same thing happens to everyone else that he meets, obviously, because they're being brought to the same place and given the same new information, and information that obviously, again, turns their world upside down. This is like being in Plato's cave or something and then being taken out of Plato's cave. And his reaction, it just ping-pongs all over the place, but not in a coherent way. Like, one moment I was feeling rage at the next, you know, it was just, he observes people having different reactions to it. And all of them are kind of middle of the road. There's not really... Yeah. It's very strange. And his own reaction is at first it's rage with his boss slash now his recruiter. But that quickly dissipates. And then they're just throwing references around again. And later yeah, it returns. And yeah, it's very weird.
Some point that like he's like, you know, some of the recruits looked very nervous, but most of them seem to be having the time of their lives.
Yes, that was in my in a sentence that I thought had the most cliches in one short sentence that I could find.
You have the whole thing.
A few of them look terrified, like lambs being led to the slaughter, which I'm sure he's seen a lot of in his. But the vast majority appeared to be having the time of their lives. So we've got lambs being led to the slaughter, vast majority, which he's only he says he's seeing like handfuls of people as they're coming out, like the vast
right,
majority. You don't use the
ship.
Word vast majority when you refer
exactly.
to a dozen people.
Yeah, it's all it's missing is they were having their time of their lives, you know, like, you know, all it was missing was Patrick Swayze hoisting Jennifer Grey at the final, you know, the final dance move type of thing. Like that was that'd be the full Kleinian twist on that sentence.
I'm sure that was just an editor red penning that. I'm sure
please,
that existed.
For the love of God, we don't need this. Yeah. There was a, but at some point in time in this section, as we move on to him getting recruited and introduced to all the equipment and stuff. But right before that, there was something that I wanted to talk about. And it was just a brief aside. It was the memory of his morning that day when his hot mom had made him her signature dish, which she calls her monstrous meatloaf, which once you've bought into the guy being very attracted to his insanely hot mom, him just shoving his face full of her monstrous meatloaf is a very unsettling image.
Yeah, that was disturbing because I applied the your rule of just inserting insanely hot mom whenever she's mentioned because he's worried about not being able to call her, right? He has this comm link where he can talk to anyone in the universe instantaneously and with no lag, but we'll get to that in a moment. So I just copied it down and did the insertion here.
Okay.
Which meant I wouldn't be able to call my insanely hot mom and tell her I was all right. Suddenly, I wanted very badly to hear my insanely hot mom's voice. Had the school called my insanely hot mom yet? Had they told my insanely hot mom? My insanely hot mom had to be going crazy with worry right now. And then he goes on to describe the weird breakfast and the interchange.
Oh, yeah.
It's just like
I wrote that down. She'd watched me stuff my face, grinning from ear to ear, and pausing every few minutes to tell me to slow down and chew my food. So she sounds like the witch in Hansel and Gretel, like watching him, like, you know, keep eating, young boy. But she's pausing every few minutes to tell me to slow down. So this is something. This is a process of 15 minutes or so of him just like gorging on this meatloaf, like as breakfast.
Well, yeah. She was doing it with her Gandalf voice on. So it was, it made a lot more sense. It was like she was chastising the hobbits for having second breakfast. And that's what made it happy.
You shall not waste meatloaf.
Yes.
Yeah. So yeah, but that was the next thing that happens. He goes and gets introduced to Foyle, who's the Q of the group. Who I thought it was funny. He even got a name because he was such a richly developed character. But he the best part of this I thought was when he was like talking to Ray, and he says, "What if I decide I want to go home?" Yes. And Ray, Ray responds, "Well, then I would remind you that you are an 18-year-old citizen of the USA and therefore legally subject to military conscription." And Zach replies, "Wait, so I'm being drafted right now?" And then Ray immediately says, "Not really. No one's going to force you to fight. If you want to go home after the briefing, just say the word."
That is so Kleinian. Why did you bring it up? What is
well
the
done.
Point?
Yeah. And like, you know, that later on, as he's like forced to undergo like a weird user and license agreement, end user license agreement. Like, it's like, well, there was no threat of them forcing him to stay here. He has to like repeat this pledge. And
yeah, but you know, what he's threatened with by Ray, his father figure boss, is sure, no problem. I'll send you back with a first class seat on the Chicken Shit Express. So that's the high level recruitment techniques of this global army.
It's supposed to, you know, just that's how military guys talk in the movie. The Top Gun instructor, that guy is probably the inspiration for that kind of thing. But yeah, it kind of rings hollow when you've just undercut that nobody is being forced to do anything and everyone can do whatever they want to.
But the Q guy, I think this is the Q guy who gives him his Q com, the one who, because you didn't get it, tells him that he's Q. That was the other thing that I like. I'm kind of like Q. I wanted to give a very brief dramatic reading of this paragraph that I really liked. So Q is giving the thing, and then he says, he lowered his voice as if imparting a secret. They're a real bitch to use, though. Take a lot of practice. Still leaning forward conspiratorially, the corporal whispered, each one has a built-in weirding module. He raised his own Q-com and crossed his wrists as he held it out in front of him. By using sound and motion, you'll be able to paralyze nerves, shatter bones, set fires, suffocate an enemy, or burst his organs. So all of that was in a conspiratorial tone. You can just tell me. Everybody else knows what's going on.
Right, yes. And then his reaction to that, I found very similar to that, to a scene in one of our favorite movies. He says, after hearing, you can set fires, suffocate an enemy, or burst his organs, I laughed out loud. And it reminded me of yeah, man, I knew one girl. She had a dozen guys. One of them beat her up so bad, she ended up in a hospital on Guerrero Street.
Oh, Mark, what a story.
And, after reading that and then being like, all right, I guess there is something here, because that was a reference to Dune.
Yes, and the guy goes on to say that, because every time he makes a reference, of course, he doesn't leave it there. He circles back and makes sure, he does a wink and a nod and like, ding, get it, and then then the scene is over, but he can't do it. The guy actually says something about it, like, he appreciated that I made a Dune reference, or is it something that clumsy?
No, so is that guy who's, you know, been evidently probably recruited here for hours, for years, he's in a high-level position. Is he doing this shit to every person that comes through the gate? He's saying that I'm Q, but I only get to hand out this one thing, and then lowering his voice to a conspiratorial tone and making the same Dune reference, just hoping someone's going to get it.
I guess maybe there's a bunch of them. They're franchised in a way. He has a little tag on or something. But because there's a massive amount of people being recruited, right?
Right.
There's auditorium.
I suppose, yeah. I guess make your workplace fun, but.
Right. He enjoys his job. It's like when you stop into a CVS at midnight or something and there's a happy guy there. You're like, I like this guy. He's
right, sure. But I wouldn't read a book about him.
that's true.
But yeah, so he meets another pilot. He seems, like we said, his world's been turned on his head, but he seems irritated that this he's met one of the players who's ranked like one spot above him.
Yes.
So that's a reasonable reaction to have at this point in time in your life. Ray is heading out. He says that this is something that I read and I was like, wait a second. Ray is going to go with his 30 for 30 or whatever. They're going to go and defend the entire Eastern Seaboard. which is something that is only ever in like Michael Bay movies, the phrase Eastern Seaboard.
Yes.
Like no one. Yeah. And you never hear about the Western Seaboard. Like we never, they sort of get the shaft in the Seaboard game.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. The Eastern is the only one represented.
I'm Googling that right now. I want to see what the distance.
You're here live Googling, ladies and gentlemen.
Eastern Seaboard has 500,000 results. And?
Well, the West Coast, I guess. Is that the substitute phrase?
Oh, what the hell? Why is it not a Seaboard? Western Seaboard has 250,000, half as many. Yeah, it doesn't even get a Wikipedia page. West Coast of the United States.
It's like I lived in the greater Chicagoland area for a while.
That's always bugged me, too.
Chicagoland. It's the playground that you go to. Nobody right, calls well, it that you know, except in ads, so it's right. Weird.
All right. Well, so the he sends him off, his father figure. You know, they at this point in time have to assume, even though Zach has no idea what's going on, Ray has to assume that he's never going to see this sort of child that he's watched grow up, mentored. This must be, in all odds, the last time he ever sees him. And he sends him off with a hearty hug and a may the force be with you always.
Was he? I think he was surprised to find himself hugging back. I think there was another out of body. I might be wrong. I don't have it in front of me. But he hugged.
I wouldn't
him
bet
back.
Against. Yeah. So that's you know, we're reading a book where the Star Wars references are shamelessly lathered on, and I don't think we're going to have to keep track of them anymore, just because they're very prominent. One guy even pointed out that I had missed one. The leader Red Jive. That's a Star Wars reference, I guess. Ugh. That. Luke Skywalker's call sign was Red 5, so that's we're in the thick of it.
Oh wait, before because I think we're now Rey is leaving and there's the Star Wars reference there. But before that, before we miss this, I just wanted to this little tidbit bugged me. So he meets the kid who the 15-year-old who's ahead of him on the list, right? And
yeah.
He signs an autograph and everything.
And then, him.
Yeah, and he turned and hurried off in another direction. Once he was out of sight, Ray and I continued walking. We passed through, and it just made me wonder, because he was sitting. Ray was going, we got to get going. You have to stop signing this guy's autograph. And yet, when he hurries off in the other direction, they wait until he's out of sight, and then they continue walking. Why is this? It's such a Kleinian thing. Like he uses a cliche. Once he was out of sight, like he doesn't know how to do motion. You know, he doesn't know that you don't have to describe the motion that's happening. Like, we watched him, okay, and then once he was out of sight, then we turned and we started walking. Like, no, you were in a hurry. You don't even have to say that you were walking.
Exactly.
Then, you know, then we entered the play. Then we got here, whatever. It's so
we had a whole, there was a leaked scene from the Ready Player One movie where they employed that technique, I think, walking through the IOI.
That's correct.
IOI office.
Man, I'm glad we are well connected. By the way, we have some leaked footage again. I was able to get. Yeah, that's coming up later. I'm just want to tease that. So
all right. Well, yeah. Let's move on to the next chapter. But before we do that, let's read some fanfic. And now I bet they bitching cause my flow switching, trying to tell me what to write. I bought some fan fiction. Can't they just be happy? I no longer have to face eviction. That I'm living on my life. I'm living on my inner vision right now.
Oh, man, a favorite segment of mine, and I hope yours, I know yours, and I hope our people out there. And given that they are the ones writing our bits of fan fiction, I believe that that is true.
Yeah, people have honestly stepped up. This is it's more of a challenge, because as we've seen, this is not employ some of the same tropes as Ready Player One, so it's been fun to see people adjust their styles on the fly.
Yeah, and they have, for my taste anyway, they have nailed it. Now, you did a great job last time of seeing through their ruses, because I think it was coin flip, but maybe you have a special insight. But do you want me to go first this time?
Yeah, you go first, and I'll see if I have just as good of luck this time around.
All right.
How many do you have?
I have three, and the rule here is... they could all be fan fiction. They could all be from the book.
Yeah.
Or any combination thereof. And
yes,
so you don't have to
not
like,
just
pick out one.
You gotta
nail them all. Okay. Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker, Lex cheered over the radio at my kill. Wait, what? I said in sudden surprise. You know, she said, from Die Hard. I rolled my eyes. Of course I knew it was from Die Hard. My mom and I would always throw it on Christmas Eve rather than suffer through something overly schmaltzy like It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Story. It was, after all, a true classic, a trend-setting film that defined the action genre for over three decades and inspired a parade of imitators from Home Alone to Speed to Air Force One and even to its own terrible, terrible sequels. I was quite familiar with it. That's number one.
All right. I think that one may have... That one may have gotten a little cocky at the end.
Well, don't tip your hand. Think about it. Think about it a little. This is number two. I sat there in silence, considering what Professor Hawking's force ghost hologram had just told us. We'd known the universe was quantized since the beginning of the last century. How long had they been keeping us in the dark about our reality? I don't get it, said Milo gruffly. Woody offered an explanation. Our universe is composed of bits of information. We are an 8-bit game being played in some 16-bit alien basement. Milo still looked confused, so I lent a hand. We Nintendo, they Super Nintendo, I grunted, using my best Tarzan voice. Me Tarzan, I finished. Everyone, even Milo, had to laugh at that.
Oh, my God.
All right, that's two, and here's three. I pushed the joystick down and my interceptor fell from the sky, coming up next to Lex's robot. Hop on, I said. When they blow me up, you'll get a boost. She jumped on my ship and surfed it like a hoverboard. A few seconds later, the gun turret nailed me and my ship exploded, launching Lex over the barricade. Thanks for the lift, Iron Beagle, she laughed. As you wish, I whispered over the explosion. Her eyes went wide and she gasped, recognizing the quote from the classic 80s movie, The Princess Bride.
Oh, man. Oh. All right. Well,
one, two, three.
Yeah, I think they're all convincing. They're all really convincing. I think that the listing of all the other 80s movies that Die Hard inspired might have been where that one went a little off the rails for me. So I think that was fanfic. I think that, God, two is bad. Two is really bad because they're laughing at his yeah. grunting and 16-bit Tarzan impression. But I think it might be real. And three, I think, is also fanfic.
Oh, number two fooled you. They were all fanfic.
Holy shit. Wow.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Isn't that nice? They have caught on.
Yeah, definitely. Wow. I mean, three I thought could have gone either way, too. But two, I was like, oh, man.
All of those had people send in slightly longer samples that had almost like punchlines that since I was trying to fool you, I didn't read, but even the punchlines were not even outside of the realm. So they all made me laugh out loud.
Oh, wow. Well done. That was really good.
Yeah.
Let's see. I'm not sure how mine are going to stack up. Let's see how that works. Let's go with number one. Ray shrugged. You mean you're not ready to boldly go where no man has gone before? As long as we don't end up in the Delta Quadrant, I smirked, and Ray shot back a knowing smile. During my first year working at Starbase Ace, Ray and I had spent countless hours watching Star Trek reruns, constantly debating the merits of each Starfleet captain. I always deferred to Picard's stern demeanor, while Ray admired Janeway's calm under pressure. On this mission, I was going to need the best of both worlds.
Okay, I think I know, but continue. Okay.
That's one. Number two. We crossed into space. Other than having a Fast Times at Ridgemont High encounter with Ellen, I just fulfilled my greatest fantasy. My mouth fell open as I looked out the window. The Earth looked like a blue Tatooine, and I was Skywalker, unsure of where I was headed, but knowing I was an important part of it.
Okay.
There were four men and one woman, and all of them looked familiar to me, but I only recognized two of them by name. The two men whose faces appeared in the last two video windows on my screen. The first was Neil deGrasse Tyson, and the second was Dr. Stephen Hawking, slumped in his motorized wheelchair. I heard Cruz and Deal gasp behind me, just as my own jaw dropped open like a castle drawbridge.
Oh, wow. Are those in total?
I have one more.
Okay.
This one's a little long, but it's... I settled into the pilot's chair and picked up the long checklist. Ugh, I thought to myself, this is going to take forever. Fasten seatbelts, check. Skimming the rest of the list, I muttered to myself, seal all entrances and exits, close all shops in the mall, cancel the three-ring circus, secure all animals in the zoo. Screw this. I grabbed hold of the control yoke. Ludicrous speed, go! I blasted out the side of the mountain base just as the hangar doors opened wide enough to allow passage. I may have even scraped the top a little. Okay, there were sparks. Once clear, I started doing barrel rolls and loop-the-loops. I set out to push myself and my ship to the limit. Then I noticed the flashing red lights were still flashing. In fact, there were rather a lot of them. Reaching behind my pilot's chair with one arm to try and find the previously discarded checklist, I tried to keep control with the other, but to no avail. Eventually, as the klaxons reached their fevered pitch and most of the controls went dead, all the screens went blank, and the gull-wing door on the side of the simulator opened up to slowly reveal a very pissed-off tech. Congrats, Porkins. You fail.
Oh, no. Oh,
all right, so we had Boldly Go Star Trek. We had Tatooine and Skywalker. We had Neil deGrasse Tyson, Hawking, Cruise, and Deal. And then we had Congrats, Porkins, You Fail.
Oh, no. Now I fear deeply that one of these is real. Now that's thrown off my whole calculus is thrown off. Oh, no. I have to say, I don't know. Again, crapshoot. I think one, two, and three are fan, and four is real?
Congrats, Porkins, you fail.
Yeah.
You are wrong! One,
is there
two,
a real one
four.
In there?
Three is real.
No way!
He goes on to meet it's Dr. Stephen Hawking and Neil deGrasse Tyson while Cruise and Deal gasp and his jaw drops open like a castle drawbridge.
Oh, my God. I thought someone was gilding the lily in a way that's like, that is very funny, but there's no way.
Yeah, it's like the Game Master Anthony's party. All these people just come in. It's or like how Will Wheaton and Cory Doctorow were the president and vice president of the Oasis.
Oh, man, that is excruciating.
well done, everybody. So that was I had the one that tricked you was from Michael J. Nick had written Boldly Go. Nathan had written Blue Tatooine, and Ernest Klein wrote the one about Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Oh man, wow, that is rugged. So yeah, two big mistakes from both of us this time. That's
good.
That's well done.
So yeah, well done, everybody. Keep those coming. Send them in through the email address and put them as an attachment so we can not read them, so we can read them blind. Yeah, and those are great. And before we move on to chapter 9, and probably you too, Mike, I wanted to wish Janelle a happy 30th birthday. It's her birthday the day that we release this. She has written in pretty much every podcast. She has written in a long tome of her gripes to this to the chapters we've been reading, and has always sent good dumb sentences of the week. So happy birthday, Janelle.
Janelle, fan fiction, please. Has she written in any?
She has. She has submitted one this time, but I had other ones I wanted to use. So maybe next time. But have a great 30th birthday.
Happy birthday, Janelle.
And now we move on to the meet cute of our story.
Oh boy,
where he meets the Artemis of this story, I guess, the Lexicutioner.
Yeah, boy, this was this again. If you had read this straight out as a fanfic, there is absolutely no way that this couldn't be. It's unbelievable. But they go into a big auditorium. There's a couple things before we meet Lexinator. Yeah. What is her name?
Yes. Lexicutioner. It's a portmanteau, Mike.
Yeah, thank you. That word has come up a lot. He sees everyone streaming into this large auditorium where they're going to do this big briefing. I spotted people in business suits, fast food uniforms, surgical scrubs, and one dazed-looking middle-aged woman who was wearing a wedding dress and still clutching her bridal bouquet. So they file into the stadium, and it says they file in row after row, one after another, the way we did at school assemblies. And it just made me wonder, did the surgeon and the woman who is still clutching her bridal bouquet, did they just file into the auditorium as though it were a school assembly?
Muscle memory.
I guess they did.
Yeah, but, I The wedding woman was one of my favorite characters, and I suppose, you know, that's supposed to be a touch of humor, but it was a jarringly took you out of the moment to be like, well, all right, so this middle-aged woman is also one of the greatest gamers in history, and, you know, that betrays my own ignorance, because of course a middle-aged woman could be one of the greatest gamers in the world, but she is still clutching the bridal bouquet despite having traveled to space and back, and then gotten off and recruited and handed her QCOM by foil and heard about the weirding device, but the bouquet has survived.
Yep. And you say that it was a touch of humor. Of course it was, and yet so was First Class Ride on the Chicken Shit Express. So yes, that's the right level of humor that we're operating at.
I'd like to think that she was going to get married to the guy from Ready Player One who had installed an immersion rig in his scrotum. I think that might have been a match made in heaven.
Exactly. All right, so let's get to it. The Lexicutioner.
He approaches her, and he just starts going into the type of language that he's usually only reserved for, you know, his mom to describe her beauty and in that only that vague, creepily sexual way that only Klein can really whip out. Klein or any guy complimenting a woman's appearance on Twitter could probably do. But he notes that she has pale alabaster skin contrasted sharply with her dark clothing, black combat boots, black jeans, and a blank black tank top, which didn't fully conceal the black bra she was wearing underneath.
She had a spiky wave of black hair that was buzzed down one side and chin length on the other, which I didn't ever think was a hair length, but chin length. But the real kicker were her tattoos on each arm. On the left was a beautiful semi-nude rendering of the comic book heroine Tank Girl, adorned in post-apocalyptic rock lingerie and smooching an M16. I mean, hopefully no one listening to this podcast, get the kids out of the room, because this is bizarre. On her right bicep, in stylized capital letters, were the words, El Riesgo Siempre Vive. Yes.
It means the risk always lives.
Yes, and did he pull that out of thin air? Did he make that up? Is he drawing this character from his own imagination? No, of course not.
It's from Aliens, and a character named Vasquez wears it.
Yes. I don't know what to say about this. I mean, seriously, if you had read that the one sentence that a spiky tattoos, a beautiful semi-nude of Tank Girl, you would have said to the person who sent you that fanfic, like, you know, I don't think Mike is not going to go for this.
I appreciate the effort, but like, you've got to be more subtle here.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
But yeah, because the sweat is just pouring off him as he's like, you know, sort of like lurching up to this girl like like one of the, you know, the hottest women at Comic-Con that walks around and everyone takes pictures with them type of thing. But it's it's very similar to the character in the last book, where it just, or to her avatar at least, where it just has that exact sort of, she's so hot, but she also is, you know, kind of a nerd, as we've talked about before, because she's already field stripping her QCOM device and putting it back together. She also later on indicates that she is a programmer who debugs subroutines in the effort to make apps and operating systems for mobile devices.
And in the meantime, he's describing the cartoon wolf things that he's doing to himself. It's unbelievable. I'm surprised he's even aware of it. He's not sitting off to the side. You know, then I noticed my tongue came out 16 feet, rolled out, and then flagged, and, you know, my eyes.
I heard the sound of a chair banging on a table, and then I realized I was the one doing it.
My feet were off the ground somehow as I banged on the table. The auga horns were going off.
But yeah, so he's just, he quickly goes on to indicate that he is just as much a fan of her personality, but he is horny as hell for this woman. But she is, not only is she incredibly hot and also kind of a nerd, she's also a Olympian level banterer, because he walks right up and she's sipping out of her R2-D2 flask. But she just shoots him down right away with the classic Klein line, go find another female of the species to mac on. Which, if it rings a bell, that's because in one of his early chats with Artemis in Ready Player One, she says, answer the question, Claire, are you ugly? And Parzival says, I must be. Why? He replies, well, the female of the species has always found me repellent.
What is that? And is Mac on? Is that a thing? I mean, that strikes me as something from a 30s movie. Like, stop macking on that dame. And you know.
I think it came back into to parlance and probably like when I was in sixth grade with Chris Cross. They were the Mac Daddy and the Daddy Mac. But glad to see it made a comeback.
Yeah.
People have said for 25 years. But I think that's from I looked it up at a – it's probably not from this because it would be a little too much credit, but there's a Rudyard Kipling poem called The Female of the Species.
Oh,
there was also an annoying 90s song called that was in an Austin Powers movie called The Female of the Species.
Well, you'll be happy to know that she's not only is she beautiful, she sort of has a tough exterior, and she's obviously very smart, and she has the repartee of, I don't know, like a Howard Hawks movie from the 30s where she's just given as well as getting from this guy. But yes. She also has a very tender marshmallow inside. And this was a line that was near spit take because I was I was having a beverage at the time, and I'm not kidding. She lives with her grandma. She volunteers something about her grandma, like, boy, oh boy, I hope my grandma doesn't miss me or something.
Right.
Are you and your grandma close? I asked, just to hear her talk some more. She nodded. My folks both died in a car crash when I was little. It's so Kleinian. Like, she just offers that information. You know, she's tough. She's like people old enough who will remember Pinky Tuscadero from Happy Days or something seems to be his reference. Like, she's spitting and snapping her fingers and chewing gum. But yeah, she's soft and tender.
But and to add on to that, you know, to the repartee and the toughness, she also finds him hilarious because he's whatever he's saying, which are quips of a. I don't even, you know, they're not good quips. No one is making jokes that are funny here. And lest we remind you, he's just had his world rocked on its heels. But he's, you know, saying stuff and she's just like snorting booze through her nose at the level of laughter that he's causing her to emit here. And the things that the first thing that she laughs at are when he references her tattoo, which makes her laugh. Which was reminiscent of the Ready Player One exchange where she catches his obscure Highlander quote and throws it right back at him.
Yes.
And but other things that make her laugh, here are some of the lines that trigger this incredibly attractive woman to laugh. You called me babyface and it wounded my masculine pride. that triggers out loud laughter.
She laughed.
She says another line that triggers it is, huh. A pedophile with a drinking habit.
Wow.
That was the third in a string of yuckers. Later on, he takes a drink from the flask, even though he's not 21. And she chants the Judas Priest song, Breaking the Law, which makes him almost do a spit take. She finishes her flask, says, I've lost R2, and then mimics the little blue droid's famous whistling sign, which, though he has spent probably 3 hours a day for the past 14 years, probably talking about Star Wars, this manages to draw a very loud laugh from him that makes people in the auditorium turn and look to tell them to shut up.
Yeah, that happened a couple times. People, after being yanked from their places of work, their homes, off the altar of getting married and being told that there was an alien race invading, they're still shushing people in the crowd. It's like, hey, come on, man. Well, let's show a little respect here.
Right. And someone had written in to sort of make the point that we were making just here. Trevor wrote in, he said that we should do a segment called Fix This Sentence, where you just point out a stupid moment and say how the author could have done it better. And he says he cites the Snake Plissken moment. So they've just been told they have probably about 8 hours to live because the aliens are invading. And she looks at her QCOM, watching the seconds tick down. Now I feel like Snake Plissken. I snorted out a wholly inappropriate laugh that echoed through the silent auditorium. And then he says, in order to make it better, you could have it. Jesus, Lex muttered, staring at the QCOM strapped to her wrist, watching the seconds tick down. Now I feel like Snake Plissken. Frowning, I got up and moved away from the lunatic woman so I could pay better attention to the world-alteringly important briefing.
That's good. You forgot one comic interchange, if I may.
Okay.
He says, you put me at the controls of a giant battle mech. I will crush my enemies and see them driven. Oh, she says this, and see them driven before me. I grinned. What about the lamentations of their women? Oh, yeah, she said, chuckling. Their women lamentate all over the place. That goes without saying, doesn't it? So that combines the not funny thing being stretched out in that Kleinian way where he then has to explain it and someone has to acknowledge the reference and then make sure that everyone gets it. Yep. All the while chuckling at it.
Yes. It's like a forum exchange where someone has, you know, made the reference and then people are just sort of quoting that, adding on to the rest of the lyrics of the song or the rest of the steamed ham Simpsons bit. Like, no, we all understand.
Right. That's why we all made understand. The reference. Just
adding on to it is, just making it, making me question whether I was right to ever like it in the first place.
Yes. But then they're so they get their briefing then from the admiral, right?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. First, there's the video that they play.
Oh yeah,
before the admiral comes. I got ahead of myself. People, don't spoiler alert if you're reading that you haven't read that part.
Yeah. Well, the chapter ends with a very funny. Another remark she makes, and it was very strange to me because it was something that I didn't realize that I knew the reference. It's one of the rare references he makes without explaining it to the reader. And people can let me know if this is correct or not because I don't remember. But we did a movie at Riff Tracks called Oblivion.
Right.
And we are coincidentally enough looking at the sequel to it right now. And watching that sequel reminded me that he makes a joke in Oblivion where the guy is introducing himself to an Indian and his name is Zack Stone. And he goes, my name is Zack Stone. And then the Indian says, well, it's nice to meet you, Zack Stone, which is like, you know, I guess a vaudeville type of joke.
Yeah, exactly.
But so when he says, I'm Zack Lightman, she says, well, it's great to meet you, Zack Lightman. And, you know, I'm not putting it past him that he thinks Oblivion, which is absolutely a terrible movie, sees some sort of value in that joke right there.
Oh, I would not doubt it one bit. This might be his deepest cut that he cherishes the most and thinks is so funny, and all of his, and you know, Will Wheaton like gives him the wink and the nod and the thumbs up and stuff like that. Like, yeah, you get it. This guy gets it.
Yeah.
This might be an Easter egg. Yeah.
Yeah, so he might be a fan of George Takei, like crossing his eyes and like, you know, looking at the whiskey bottle as he downs it in those scenes in Oblivion.
Oh, yeah. If people out there, if you are currently a George Takei fan, I urge you to never see Oblivion or Oblivion 2. I mean, it is beyond awful. It will change your opinion of the man to the core. Trust me.
Bill wrote and said that he should be in actor jail for this performance.
Yes, it is unbelievable.
So let's move on to the briefing because that's a lot of stuff going on in the briefing. Before that, however, I want to say that we posted this on our social media accounts for the podcast that we made some T-shirts, or more appropriately, a designer named Lucas Antoniak made us some T-shirts that have the iconic, classic 372 pages logo. They say hell of a rig. And just this week, he made us a brand new one. He did an original sketch of the inflatable fetish cow that inspired the hell of a rig. And that is now on a T-shirt. And people have bought the logo shirts. I'm surprised by that. No one has bought that cow shirt
what?
Since we put it up, I believe, 48 hours ago. And this is bullshit, people, because this is a Lucas spent a lot of time on this shirt. It looks awesome. And it's a conversation starter. Like, there's no way you can not be wearing this and not have someone come up and ask you what on earth your t-shirt that says that's a hell of a rig and has a inflatable cow sort of sexily turning to the camera. You're going to be the most popular guy wherever you go.
Well, yeah. And especially if you're going to, dinner at your grandparents or something, your grandfather who fought in the Vietnam War, he's gonna turn to you and give you a nice wink and a nod. He knows what that is and he loves it. Come on.
You're going to you're meeting your fiance's parents for the first time and you want to be like, I promise that I will hold your son or daughter dear to my heart and I will be there for them and I just want to know that I feel that I'm a part of your family now. And then you can explain to them that, I listened to a podcast where they talk about how a book is really bad. And a while ago, those guys were on a body fetish inflation forum. And then
say no more. So
yes, it's a moment for the wedding speech. So yeah, those are on, we'll post the links again. They're on TeePublic if you search for 372 pages and they're really great. And check out Lucas's work. He has a website at riseofthemolecule.com, which we'll also link to, but someone better buy that shirt.
I'm shocked that it hasn't been yet, but it has only been 48 hours. It could be just people getting their orders together, like all the family members, calling out like, look, we haven't talked to grandpa yet. We need to know what size he needs. So that could be what it is.
Yeah. I'll make them available as baby onesies if that's what it takes. I mean,
that's obviously going to push it over the edge.
Yeah. So now we move into their briefing about the, about why they're all here, essentially. Like they have been relatively kept in the dark. I mean, I guess they've revealed that the EDA is real and the Armada game was real things to it, but they still don't know exactly why they have been summoned here.
And he knows, just to remind everyone, he knows that it's all real because he saw it in the opening sentence of the book. So he saw the invasion starting or whatever. So that he's known that forever.
But we should probably keep an eye out for the this was something that just caught my eye, no pun intended, the word cyclopean appears three times in this next stretch of the book, and a reader wrote in, also noticed this, it does not appear anywhere else in the book, but the word cyclopean, which once you see it in print, you've probably never seen it before, and you will never see it again in this book because it burns bright during these next 20 pages, but then it is left behind, never to be seen again. And that is just an editor not doing their job, because he uses it to refer to the EDA logo. He uses it to refer to the famous red spot of Jupiter, and he uses it kind of cruelly to refer to the eye patch commander guy, Corporal Vance. So it's
what a weirdo. That's what a weirdo. And are we saying yours is, you said cyclopean?
Oh, sure.
Well, no, I don't. I don't think there's any official
cyclopean.
I would read it cyclopean. I always, Herculean, that word.
Yeah.
I always wonder. I switch between sometimes at the reading it Herculean, Herculean. Anyway.
Yeah,
it's cyclopean, cyclopean. It could be either one.
Yeah, and it's definitely a word that sounds weirder the more that you say it.
Yep.
But my favorite part of this was they start showing this video, and right away they're showing this space footage. I guess it's CGI, but he says, I recognized it as one of the twin Pioneer 10 and Pioneer 11 spacecraft, the first two probes NASA spent to survey our outer solar system. And that's right, Mike. He has memorized NASA. He's taken it to the next level of Kleinian rote memorization of popular things, and he's just memorized the space program, something he's heretofore exhibited zero interest or knowledge of.
Back-to-back viewings of the launches of those things, I'm sure.
But yeah, so he's Carl Sagan starts narrating this, and everyone in the room recognizes this right away.
This is a running theme in this that, again, you have to read the whole thing to realize what is going on? Why is he going back to this? But his interest in Carl Sagan, I think, almost verges on his interest in his own insanely hot mom. I'm a little worried about that. He references at least three, probably four times about his, does he call it a rich tenor or something, or his...
Yeah, calming.
It just, you get the sense eventually, like, yeah, it's Carl Sagan. I mean, is he really noted mostly for his voice, because then he references James Earl Jones.
He says, James Earl Jones.
Yeah, he's like, if he had been doing it, I'd be terrified. But when Carl Sagan reads it, oh, God. He just imbues it with believability. But there does seem to be some undertone of eroticism that frightened me with this thing. And I don't remember. I mean, Carl Sagan has a distinctive voice in some ways, but it's not. I don't think he was noted voiceover performer Carl Sagan.
Right, no, he was a little before my time, so I don't know if I would recognize his voice. But I do, he's obviously talking about James Earl Jones because his only association is with Darth Vader, which of course is menacing. But yeah, I've always found, James Earl Jones' baseball speech in Field of Dreams is very comforting and moving. And
it's like the centerpiece of the film. That's what he's noted for. Yeah,
it's incredible that he is just like, would immediately just diss this fine actor out of nowhere. Mufasa is a everything the light touches, Simba, is like a touching moment between father and son. Go to hell, Ernest Cline.
Yes. So he reveals, Carl Sagan in that sexy voice of his reveals that the moon of Jupiter, Europa, is covered with a large Nazi symbol. We touched on this last time in Fanfic or Real. I just pulled that out.
Right.
I mean, you were puzzled by that. Well, here it comes. And there's no explanation for it. Everyone's baffled by it. And so they send a probe back. But here's something I wanted to note. Speaking of memorizing NASA, he says, after racking my brain for what seemed like an eternity, I realized the answer was staring me in the face. Carl Sagan himself had written a similar scenario into his first and only science fiction novel, Contact. So why the hell does he have to he has everything in the world memorized, NASA included, with total and instant recall. He makes references to everything. But here he's racking his brain for what seems like an eternity. Why does he have that at the tip of his? I don't understand. Like that, right. It's such a Kleinian thing. So he sat there. How long did he sit there for what seemed like an eternity trying to think of the fact that it was from Contact? And then he just does think of it. He remembers it. But why? What is that thing?
I've never seen or read that, but I assume that would be a fairly, if he saw a monolith somewhere, none of us would take any more than a second to be like, oh, it's like that 2001 monolith. Like, it seems like that's probably a decent plot point in the book. And seeing a swastika on a moon, if you've seen that movie, would probably be like, oh, it's like Contact.
Right. Exactly.
But yeah, so I guess Carl Sagan was just hiding Dan Brownian sort of clues in the book in order to more acclimate society to these to this preposterous plan. Like, that was just sort of their way of gradually getting people used to the idea that aliens might be out there, the sort of the centerpiece of why this all makes sense.
Yeah, so in this presentation video, then they reveal that, and they reveal that then they drilled a core in the swastika was like in the ice. It was like this onyx ice, I guess. And so they try to drill through it because the crust is only so thick. And when they do, then a little girl voice is beamed to them that says, we are going to kill you.
Yeah. And then I'm sure added in a few la 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 las.
Yeah. And it repeats over and over and over again. And then the race gears up for battle on it. And he says at one point, he notes, for decades, we had all been inundated with a steady barrage of science fiction novels, movies, cartoons, and television shows about aliens of one kind or another. And I just noted, yeah, mostly that anti-alien propaganda, Star Wars, that was the one that mostly influenced you.
Turn people against the idea of anyone who's different or any other worlds.
Yes.
Yes, and he explains that as if it makes – I thought I knew why. Like, extraterrestrial visitors had permeated pop culture for so long that they were now embedded in humanity's collective unconscious, preparing us to deal with the real thing now that it was actually happening. And that's the this episode's show or tell, not show example. It just – we talked last week about how this premise makes no sense, of course, from a financial standpoint, and how Hollywood is taking a gigantic risk by doing all this, but it's also just not it doesn't need the constant onslaught of video games and everything to make people accept that, because people are sure aliens. We understand how that would work. We understand you know, that they may be friendly like E.T., or they may be hostile like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or they may be, you know, like Arrival. They may just sort of be agnostic towards us and just want to learn. But
yep, the first human being who ever looked at the sky said, wonder, maybe there's aliens. Maybe they're... I guess they didn't have a barrage of things inundating them with the knowledge of aliens. They didn't need that.
And so if the government had, you know, made like the Starship Troopers propaganda videos, it doesn't seem like he glosses over that, being like, that wouldn't have been effective. But it doesn't seem like that's true, because we've seen the abilities of the governments of the world to rile people up into froths over people who look very similar to them.
Right.
You know, have a slightly different skin tone or a moderate religious difference. And it just doesn't ring true that we'd be unable to be like, there's a giant threat out there. Here's the proof. And let's pool our resources and kill everybody.
Yeah. I wonder how they slipped in that that seditious E.T. or Starman or name all the things.
Mac and me.
Right. Those are downright seditious, I'd say.
But yeah, so he during this whole thing, he says that he had never been glued. I had never been so glued to a movie screen in my life.
Yeah, I wrote that sentence down, and then I slight language warning. I had two words behind it. Holy shit!
So glued.
That is, I have never been so glued. I don't think you get to use cliches that way. Like, I was glued to the screen. That's the way you use that cliche. And then that is terrible and laughable in and of itself. But right. I had never been so glued.
He goes to a Neil Diamond concert enduring Sweet Caroline, yells out, so glued, so glued, so glued. But it probably was more glued to the screen even than his mom during back-to-back Say Anything viewing.
Oh, boy, I don't know. That was pretty glued.
And so, yeah, Carl Sagan keeps explaining stuff. And during this, he comes to the realization that this whole thing, Mike, is like something out of a bad science fiction movie.
Yes.
Which, you know, I just noted that there's been no indication at all that he has any sort of quality barometer. That there is things that cross his radar that say bad, like he's humming, you know, he likes the Star Wars prequels, it seems. He's down with Iron Eagle and Airwolf and all that garbage. So it's whatever. It's nice of him to suppress the name of a particular bad science fiction movie, because that would be incredibly insulting for him to.
Oh, I would love to know what doesn't rise.
He just has like a just a hatred for Titan AE or some forgotten 90s animated movie or something like that.
Oh, yeah. But then so anything else about Sagan's thing? I noted that it took him a while to believe that it was Sagan.
Yeah. He's very skeptical during this whole thing. Like, again, despite having himself being rocked on the heels, he is just like, you know, this doesn't make any sense. Like, there's more to this story than they're telling us.
Yeah, but then when he sees, I guess, a 3D recreation of Carl Sagan, then he's ready to be on board. But he has that momentary flash of anger. Like, why did Sagan suppress this? He must have had a very good reason. He just goes through all these emotions that don't make any sense. Like, that's your question? Why did Carl Sagan suppress it? He was in on it, that bastard.
Yeah, he owed us. In other situations, I would think that's more maybe to indicate his manic sort of mood fluctuations, but I am not going to give that credit. I think it's definitely just setting the stage for some sort of terrible twist that's going to happen. And that, you know, he doubts it now, and then he'll be proven right all along.
Right.
My last note about this section is that it's, I guess if it has been a cliche in the movies that Europa might be the moon that might be best suited to human life, like, he makes sense why he did it. But as he goes on to be like, the Europans were engaging, it's confusing as hell, because he's picked ones that's like, we're fighting a war. And like, I just kept reading it as the Europeans were coming
I noted that same thing. Like, stop. Why didn't you just pick something else? Yeah.
You can come up with any number of, you know, cliched sounding alien names off the top of your head. Just throw an X or a number in there, and it's very easy to do.
Yeah, one letter off from it's very easily avoidable.
I would just wanted to say that the idea of the swastika, they said, was based on contact. And he said in Contact they have the an entire scene where the first contact the aliens send is that they have a scene from the 1936 Olympics, the one that were in Berlin.
Mm-hmm.
And this, you know, I said I've never seen Contact or anything like that, but I have a scene in my new book, The Pole Vault Championship of the Entire Universe, where the aliens observe the 1936 Olympics and the come away with it impressed with Hitler. And that's a total coincidence.
Oh, wait a minute now.
Okay.
Some Kleinian influence.
I read that and I was just like, oh my God. And then when it was revealed to have come from Carl Sagan, it was a bit more of a relief. But just in case anybody thought that might be in case the two of you have read that book.
It came from Carl Sagan, but we know where you got it from. I mean,
but so that's that was surprising and somewhat depressing to read that. But in case you want to see how that gets played for comedic effect instead of dramatic, I'd direct you to check that out.
Yes, his new book. Where can they find that book?
Amazon. Search for you probably can search for 372 pages, but search for my name on Amazon and give it a read. It's better than this, I promise you.
All right, now we get to the Admiral, who I
get
jumped
to talk
ahead.
To me, people. Not in Kansas anymore.
Yep, this fella, Admiral Archibald Vance.
it's not exactly the name of a Michael Ironside's character, I don't think.
No, that's why I did not look this one up. Did you? It has to be a reference.
No, but damn it, it probably is.
You know what it probably is? It's a portmanteau of something. his favorite word to explain to people, to give them a portmanteau and then to tell them it's a portmanteau and then to tell them what a portmanteau is a very good Kleinian touch.
What was the other thing that was like he explained? Oh, a sobriquet. He's done that twice now.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So he comes out and does the we're not in Kansas anymore. The aliens are going to eat your eyes like Juju Bee's speech. And two sort of varying reactions from the crowd. But this in and of itself is a piece of propaganda because he during this speech, he's playing John Williams' score from Armada to pump up the crowd,
right?
To pump up the I assume that at the, you know, hearing the John Williams score from Armada, the bride with her bouquet shot out of her seat, and
right.
Maybe that was the point where the bouquet shot over her shoulder and was caught by someone else. I don't know.
Right, Lex catches it, and they sort of exchange. They shrug, and yeah. Mike had to. But yeah, maybe she was going to walk down the aisle to that theme song.
Yes. So he gets out and makes the big speech. And I mean, it's all pretty cliched. I don't have a lot from that. Do you have?
Yeah, there's some funny stuff. He says, I always assumed he was just an actor who had been hired to play that role, but it appeared I'd been wrong about that, too.
Yes,
when he comes out. So he's always wrong about things, but he's always convinced that he's like sniffing out the one flaw in this conspiracy that he learned about half an hour ago. Right. But when the actor comes out, you know, so they've just said the aliens are invading. They're real. They want to wipe us out and kill us all. The actor comes out and there were some scattered cheers and some muted laughter. So that sort of that gives you a signifier of the level of intelligence and maturity of the people that are working here. Like it's like you know, the guy who played Data walks out on screen like after there's at the some sort of like Holocaust reveal and the people are like, oh, cool. Like right. We recognize that guy.
Yep. Again, their reactions are so so all over the place. Their world has literally been turned upside down. Everything they believed is you know, the rug has fully been pulled out from under them and they're still like giggling and snorting. Someone probably right. blew a spit wad into his good eye or yeah. something, you know.
It's like if there was a, Comic-Con, the large auditorium, and there was a panel in there, and they just announced something that was like, all right, well, the nukes are falling, and San Diego is one of the targets. So if you wanted to say, get in touch with your loved ones, this would be a good time. And now here's the voice of Hermes from Futurama. To talk about the upcoming season.
Yes. But our stand-in for Michael Ironside here, Archibald Vance, Archie, gives the speech, and then he says, "So you know, we need you all to fight. You've been recruited. All the things we already know, filtered through the Michael Ironside type speech." But then he says, "We have reason to believe the enemy may be preparing to launch a sneak attack sometime today, somewhere on the planet Earth." And then two sentences later, red alert, this installation is under attack. And this struck me as accidentally comic, so I went looking for that. It just seemed like so, like, but relax, you know, there's no way it could possibly be here. And then and then almost immediately there's an explosion and the klaxons begin sounding.
Right.
And I thought that was stupid and Kleinian. And so when I looked into it, once again, I have contacts in the film industry, and they're making the film for Armada right now. And I got in touch with them. And as it turns out, that is supposed to be as stupid and humorous. That is a broad comic moment that they have. Right, and they didn't really know how to bring that into the movie, so they've been workshopping that. And they did, they once again, they sent me some advanced clips where they workshop this this bit. Because it is
so they were having you punch it up, or they've already been punching it up?
And they've been punching it up.
why are we like adding on to the layers of fiction here that we're receiving?
Yeah. I mean, look, if they asked me to punch it up, I mean, I am available.
Right. Well, maybe that will happen in a few trips.
Yes, that, it's possible. Anyway, let's roll some of the alternate takes at this large comic beat that they put in Armada. Here we go.
The day of reckoning is now at hand. After threatening us with extinction for 40 years, it appears the Europans have finally completed their preparations for war. And I'm here to tell you, these Europans are the worst, smelliest, most vile creatures who have ever scooted their revolting backsides like mangy dogs across the ice-covered surface of their worthless moon. They're right behind me, aren't they?
Okay, nice. Let's try a different take.
Cadets?
Yes, sir.
We have reason to believe that the Europans may be approaching this base in attack formation at this very moment. Now, don't lie to me like you did last time with that whole sneaking a camel into the women's barracks incident. Are the Europans on your radar screens right now?
No.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
No. Well, that is no, they're not on our screen now.
But Gary spilled mustard on our radar screen, so it could be a blob of that.
Shut up, Larry.
Damn it, Larry and Gary. I want a straight answer, and I want it now. Are the Europans attacking?
Well, you see, and look behind you, a Glaive fighter with no clothes on.
Gary and Larry! All right, cadets. Whatever comes through that door is bent on the destruction of mankind itself. Shoot to kill!
Afternoon, everybody.
Norman?
Hey, why are you pointing guns? You spot one of Carla's kids around here or something?
Well, yeah, that's going to work out. I mean, that's going to get people rolling in their seats.
Yeah, you know, it does. It breaks up the tension. It's obviously very tense, you know, to have your world shaken and told that you're about to die at the hands of aliens. It is good to have that comic relief. It's like in Shakespeare's Macbeth, the gatekeeper scene, you know, it's just, man, this is a tense thing. There are ghosts and murders and revenge. And then suddenly there's sort of a comic drunk scene. So I think it serves the same purpose.
I was going to say Frank Drebin in The Naked Gun, saying nothing to say here, but I'm sure that they're probably similar.
Very, very similar.
Something that I thought was unintentionally hilarious, like it made me laugh out loud as we read it, was so he's doing all this. The alarms are going off, but he's like at some point in time, a cheer rose slowly up. Oh, no, that was another line. I'll get to that in a minute. But so they're actually bombing the outside, and the reinforced structure might not be holding up. It says, another blast on the surface shook the stone floor beneath our feet once again, more fiercely this time. And there was another volley of panicked screams and shouting. And then, like, something, they're showing the outside, what's happening outside, the aliens attacking on the video monitors. The auditorium fell eerily silent for a moment as everyone stared up at the images on the screen. Then the screaming and shouting continued, now at a much higher volume.
It's just a nice comic.
They're all screaming. Yeah, it was very, it was like a Simpsons thing where they, you know, cuts to the Krusty the Clown kids in the audience just screaming as something horrible happens. And then they stop and then something else happens and they scream even louder.
Wow.
Just the entire room falling silent to only scream a bit louder and a mere seconds later.
I also noted, it's just a small thing, but he said, I think a couple times, maybe three, that after the explosions, concrete and silt fell down from the sky. And I just, the image of him, like, you know, he made sure that it was silt.
Silt.
I mean, silt is, it's a specific thing. I'm not going to ding him too hard, but the fact that he uses it a number of times.
It's good.
So, you know, dust, I don't know, concrete dust and silt fragments.
It's like a water-based feel of it to
silt
me,
is what is built up in a river it's water-based. But
yeah. A few more quick hits, just because we're going pretty long here, but he uses the phrase, a cheer slowly rose from the audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I had trouble imagining how that would sound, you know, like a cheer slowly rising is just not something that happens very often. It's usually you break out into a cheer or something triggers it, but like it sort of sounds like people are like, yay.
I figured it was more like a parliament where they're sort of grumbling all the time and then it kind of builds into, yeah, that's very Kleinian.
Flimsy, but so they go sort of like running out to find all of their individual rigs, and he notes that his rig has standard Xbox, PS, and Nintendo controllers. And I was confused about that just because I didn't know what the standard Nintendo controller was. I've used many a Nintendo controller in my lifetime, and they've all been wildly different from each other. So that was, if you can emphasize which that would be. I'm sure it never matters again, and it makes no sense that you need a Nintendo controller because we've been given many detailed descriptions of his unique rig for this game. But
which he got the day before and never used. And then, I guess he used it for that one mission. That's right.
Yes.
He used it for the one mission that turned out to be a real mission.
I'm hoping in this universe the much maligned Wii U controller is the standard one they're all issued, and that plays a role at the end of the book because that would be hilarious.
Well, here's a bit of drama, and then we should get to both our sentences. But how about the drama of the slightly different view from inside the cockpit? That was when I realized my view from inside the cockpit was slightly different than the one I was used to seeing when I played Armada. The HUD readouts and targeting reticle were identical, but they were superimposed and then blah, blah, blah. It's like, just stop asking me to picture this stuff that exists only in your head. There's no description that will make this more dramatic for me.
And impacts, these come up with my might as well do them now, but my boring sentences also deal with slight differences. I'll save them for the very end. But he gets in there, and before he takes off, he has to take his oath of office, which was another thing where the author's own tendencies shine through. He has to read the whole thing, agree to everything. And then the last line of it is, so help me God. And he says, that last line was marked as optional, but I was in a hurry, so I said it anyway, even though I'd always been a devout agnostic.
Yeah, that one struck me. Wait, agnostic? He's like openly hostile, proclaiming that he's just a bipedal ape. Like, I don't know. Why would that lead you to agnosticism?
Right, he's hedging his bets at this point in time.
Oh, man. Yeah.
But it's just a funny thing to even put in the first place, and to even have the character address that it is optional, just in case his serious fans are like, hey, man, like, you know, what are you doing? And, you know, he didn't need to put it in there.
No,
in the first
he didn't
place.
Need to have it in there. Could have avoided it entirely instead. Weird, clumsy virtue signaling of some kind, I guess.
But yeah, then he goes on out into the world of the battle, and he shoots on out there. He starts configuring his system, and he's somehow not shot down by the dozens of Glaive fighters that are already nuking things. So we found out what that is.
Give the big reveal. I mean, we knew it's a weapon, but I didn't realize, of course, he wasn't referencing the historical Glaive. Not at all. No. What was he referencing?
He was referencing the movie Krull, which you might have recognized as a mentioned in Ready Player One. But Krull, I guess a guy has a weapon called a Glaive. It has its own entry on the Krull wiki, which exists. And we were alerted to this fact because we just launched a Rift Tracks Kickstarter 2 days ago. And one of the movies we're doing as a live show this year is Krull.
Yes, so we will be living with the Glaive for many weeks.
We'll have to put a line like that in there somewhere and wait for the two people in the audience to nod respectfully that they got the reference, much in the way that characters do in this book when people get references.
Oh, I think there'll be a pause and then a cheer will slowly build in the audience. That's what I predict will be the reaction.
But yeah, if you want more information on that, go to rifttracks.com/Kickstarter and you can support that and read more about Krull. And Space Mutiny is the other movie we're doing, MST3K Classic, which, again, I am disappointed that references to that have not yet shown up in the Kleinian work, because that would be really, really funny.
I feel a bit stung. I won't lie to you. It's a slap to my face.
The last thing that I saw was he's observing his hot babe, excellent at video games player out there in her rig. But she's running around blasting things. And he says, "I watched as she launched her Sentinel into a power leap while simultaneously unloading both of its wrist cannons." And I just hope that power leaps are something that we're going to be, exposed to throughout the book, because it is a incredibly dorky phrase to unleash in the middle of mankind's first war with another species.
It's no gunting, but it is, it's pretty silly.
All right. Well, that was a lot to talk about, but I think it's time to move on to our dumb sentence of the week.
Sentences, dumb and otherwise.
A sentence begins with a capital letter. A capital letter is a letter that's big. A capital letter is not a small letter. A capital letter is big, big, big. A sentence ends with a period, or an exclamation, or a question mark. A sentence always ends with a period.
I do like that song.
Yeah, it grows on you. It had like millions of YouTube plays, I think. So.
Oh, did it?
It's not the only... we're not the only ones that are familiar with that. I'm sure that some person would like hear that on the podcast and just like be hit with something where their kid listened to that for three straight months and just until they banned them from YouTube.
Dear sirs, I am no longer a listener. all right. Why don't you go?
All right. I've got a couple from readers. This is the one from the birthday girl, Janelle. The elevator car had no floor indicator or control panel, just a single down arrow that lit up and beeped about twice every second as the car descended deeper and deeper below ground. So she was puzzled by that, because if there was no floor indicator, why on earth was it beeping? That's what it does when it passes by a floor. It only goes down. How do you get back up? What the hell is going on here?
I noted that too. Why the beeps?
And then Elizabeth wrote this one in. This was really good because it has three terrible similes. It's technically a sentence and a half. It's as they arrive in Iowa or Nebraska. One of the plowed fields adjacent to the farm collapsed in on itself, like a perfectly rectangular sinkhole, then split in two and slid apart, like two massive elevator doors set into the earth. They revealed an enormous circular shaft leading deep underground, like an empty missile silo, but much larger in diameter.
Oh, my God.
So it's three in the span of that sentence and a half, which really add nothing to it. I mean, because it's essentially all those things are those things. They're not like any of those things. It's not like, you know, it's not like an ocean wave crashing on the shore. It's like, no, it is a missile silo, just a slightly bigger one. It is a two doors openings that are set into the earth. Like,
yeah, I got to admit, sometimes when he starts any kind of physical description, like I noted that thing that she noted there, and I kind of tuned out after that. I was like, I'm just going to skip that because it's not going to help me picture whatever's happening here.
Exactly. Yeah. I didn't note how bad that was, because I did sort of gloss over it. But yeah, so I had my nomination. This is as Michael Ironsides is talking, and he's revealing that they're about to be wiped out, and there's 8 hours to live type of thing. But our hero, every time he said the word Vanguard, all I could think of was an old arcade game with that title. But that really just sums up his loathsome mindset, and there's no reason to say it. There's no reason. He goes on to sort of describe the main enemy of that, which is called like the Gant or the Gorn or the Gunt. I'm not really sure, but it devotes an entire paragraph to it. And probably just because he likes that game and was unable to keep himself from saying it.
And once again, doing the tip of the hat with no other purpose to it. Like, there exists. This is a word, and this is also a video game.
It would have been a good one to pick for fan fiction, because he says, he does the thing that a lot of the fan fiction writers do, where all I could think of was an old arcade game with that title. Vanguard was our side-scrolling,
Oh, so Kleinian. All right, I've got my dumb sentence of the week, and I'm shocked that no one else plucked it out first. And I was a little worried because I didn't even have...
Yeah. You thought this was going to be a...
I didn't even have a backup for it. This is during the briefing, and he's sitting next to Lexicon or Lex Luthor or whatever her name is. It says, beside me, I heard Lex whisper, "What the fuck?" I nodded in agreement. Oh, so Kleinian. Impossible to tell whether it's a joke or not.
Yeah, there was a very similar one too that I nodded, and then I didn't do it. But when the guy walks out on stage, he goes, "Holy shit," I shouted, and I wasn't alone.
Yes, I noted that too.
So people are also yelling that exact same thing. There's a crowd of holy shits going up.
And a few people laughing when they saw him. So there's a lot of different reactions.
People probably who didn't yell holy shit, maybe they're just more shy or something, but they probably did nod in agreement.
Yes. Do you have a boring sentence of the week?
I do. I have two.
Okay. Yours might be similar to mine, so I'll hold mine in reserve.
Okay. Let's see. Like I said before, they both center on the minutia, the differences between his gaming rig and his actual rig. The first one, the dual throttle controller by my left hand also appeared identical to Chaos Terrain's home version, except it was bolted to the armrest of my ergonomic pilot seat. So that's it just means that it's secured to the simulator. Ergonomic pilot seat is a great thing to throw in there, just because it just conjures up awful office experiences of and then the next one is he's taken off into the battlefield, but he says, I had to make a few adjustments to my controller setup, but it only took seconds because the interface was so familiar. It's like, all right, well, I if he had like
not
been,
even worth puzzled, mentioning.
Yeah, if there had been any sort of tension by the thing not being similar or whatever, it would at least it's immediately undercut in seconds during the heat of the battle because he's already so good at what he does.
That's his stock and trade, though, undercutting what little, well, I guess it's only potential small tensions. He just like, nope, yeah.
Right, that drone might get shot down and he might go to the back of the launch queue.
All right, I have one. It's not a sentence. It's a couple sentences. Is that cheating?
Okay. Nah.
All right. And see if I defy you to either picture this, number one, or number two, stay awake for this. Here we go.
Okay.
At the end of that same corridor, I reached a pair of doors labeled Controller Hub 5 and bolted through them. They opened on an enormous barrel-shaped room with hundreds of drone controller stations honeycombed into its walls, to which were bolted a network of narrow ladders and access ramps. It looked like a larger version of the drone control centers in our modest cutscenes. My QCOM display switched to a three-dimensional diagram of the room, then highlighted my station assignment DCS-537. Yeah. How's that for drama?
He acknowledges that he's describing it like a video game cutscene, but if you try to describe the experience of playing Halo or something like that, I glanced down at the map in the corner, which had a radar thing indicating the P, which was my goal, and that it's like, I don't want to hear about this. I would like to play it, sure. I do not need to read a description of it.
Yeah, it is staggering. I guess that's this part of the game that he enjoys or something, is knowing everything about it, like memorizing it and then just regurgitating it. I think that makes him happy in some way.
Right. Oh, man. Well, yep, those were boring and those were dumb. And there's a lot more to come. So for next time, I think reading up to chapter 16, which is page 205, is a good goal. Looks like a lot is going to happen. Not sure if Neil deGrasse Tyson will actually make an appearance by then. But, you know, there's a lot of great stuff being sent in. So we appreciate all of that. Please continue to do that. Send in your fan fiction, your dumb sentences. Hit us up on Twitter and buy one of the cow shirts, people. Like, I want to see one of those. I'll post it as soon as we get a sale.
Yeah. Very disappointed in you up to this point. Let's pick it up. And I would also, I guess I would advise people, not admonish them. I would advise them not to read the book all in one sitting, as I have been doing. It is starting to wear on me. And so I pledge to you that I will read a chapter at a time and finish it over the course of the week.
Good. Yeah. I don't want you to, yeah, I'm concerned about your health doing this. It's a binging this stuff is
potential burnout here. All right. That's it. You've got your assignment. Thanks for everything,
Thank
folks.
Thank you, everybody.
We will see you next time on 372 Pages. We'll Never Get Back.
Bye.